afternoon. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight, returning, is Eric Schwitzgebel. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of California, Riverside. And we're talking about his new book, The Weirdness of the World. Eric, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk about this book.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This is a wild book, Eric. I was unprepared for what I was getting involved in. Now, you're probably all used to it, but and we'll explain this as we go along. But this is one of those books that sort of blew my mind several times. It's dedicated to the world's freaks, geeks, weirdos, lovers of the bizarre, and wondrous. Had you just taken some acid or something? I mean, it's people need. I just want to tell all listeners: you have to read this book. Don't depend upon our conversation. Go ahead.
Well, I'm glad you like it so much. Yes, you know, freaks, geeks, and weirdos are underappreciated in this world. I think they need a good call out and a dedication.
So I get from your book. How did you start and get to write this book? What inspired you?
I guess fundamentally, one of the things that I like to do as a philosopher is explore the boundaries of my own confusion and where I think philosophical and scientific knowledge comes to an end. So I kind of done that in a variety of particular on a variety of particular questions, and then I wanted to bring that vision together into a sustained monograph.
And it's an interesting hypothesis that you start the book out with. You believe that this world is weird, is weird, and that's your own word. Why is it weird?
Yes, well,
and in relationship to what?
Right. So let me clarify a little bit what I mean by weird. By weird, I mean that it defies our common sense understanding. And it also defies our best attempts at philosophical or scientific understanding. There's something strange must be true about fundamental issues in cosmology and consciousness, but we don't know which among the various strange possibilities is correct. And we have no really good way of knowing that.
Yeah, you said that.
Yeah, so I think the world's weird in that sense, yes.
You said that the questions that pertain to this, for instance, how does human consciousness fit in? What is the structure of the cosmos? Two of the questions you mentioned in the book, that they are currently beyond our capacity to understand. And therefore, when we look at these, what we're looking at, we don't even know how to ask the right question.
Right. I think a lot of progress in philosophy is finding questions that we didn't even think before to ask. So just one recent example of this, a lot of people now know about the simulation hypothesis, the idea that we might be living inside a computer program.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think that's super likely, but that's an interesting
But how can you tell?
How could I tell? Yeah, we could get into that. But I think it's an interesting possibility. It's a question we didn't even know to ask a century
ago, right?
So not only do we not know, not only do we know that we don't know certain things, but there are presumably things that we have yet to discover, even to ask.
And you actually, you dump a lot of this, is it the pronunciation dubiety?
Yes.
I had never read that word before this book. You know, before I ask that question, you should probably define what dubiety is.
Right. So I regard...
Is that a real word, by the way, Eric?
You know, I didn't look it up in the dictionary.
Okay. All right.
I think it's a real word.
You could play it in Scrabble and have it count?
I would hope so, but if not... Let's add it.
Okay, cool. So
it's certainly better than dubiousness.
That I know is a word.
so is it the same thing, right? So their position is dubious. If, on my view, we're not epistemically compelled. That is, our scientific and philosophical and other sorts of evidence don't compel us to believe one option over another.
Now you place a lot of this dubiety in the lap of relativity and quantum theory.
Oh, yeah. So I think that...
Now, what did they ever do to you? I mean, I in one sense, I understand this.
That's what they did. They confused me.
But is that you just not understanding quantum theory? Although I have to say, I think it was Richard Feynman who said that if somebody says that they understand quantum theory, then they don't understand quantum theory.
Right.
That's a quote. But I mean, a lot of that falls into the way that we're actually, looking at the universe and the way it works. We apply quantum theory to that, and it seems to work out.
Well, we apply the equations of quantum mechanics to it.
Okay, you're right.
And it works out fine. Right, so I don't think the equations of quantum mechanics are in much doubt, although maybe they'll be refined and updated in certain ways. Where the dubiety and doubt and strangeness really come in are in the interpretations of those equations. Right, so...
And that's heavily debated.
For example, yeah. And that is hotly debated among experts, right? So there are kind of really two levels of confusion here. There's a kind of beginner type of confusion, and then there's an expert type of confusion. The beginner type of confusion is just even understanding what something like quantum superposition is supposed to be in the equations. Mm-hmm. And then the advanced type of confusion is, okay, we know that stuff. But what's really going on in reality behind these equations, right? So just to put out two of the relatively more well-known interpretations, right? One is the many worlds interpretation. It's sometimes called the idea that the world is constantly splitting into worlds. So anytime there's a quantum, what we might think of as a quantum chance, what really happens is both outcomes occur, but the world splits. So there's one world where the uranium atom decays, and another world in which it doesn't. So the world is constantly splitting into many, many worlds, right? That's the many worlds interpretation. Another interpretation says it has to do with observation by humans, right?
Yep.
So as soon as we observe the quantum event, that observation causes it to collapse from a state of superposition into, well, either the uranium atom decayed or it did not decay. So there's not a split of worlds. There aren't many worlds, it's just one world, but what causes the world to kind of be in the particular state it is our own acts of observation. And now, here's the thing, right? Both of those views are extremely strange.
Yeah.
And neither of those views is compelled by the scientific and philosophical evidence.
We just don't even know how to test it. We don't even know how to design an experiment that would test either of those ideas.
Correct. Right, so it's a nice entree into this general idea of the weirdness of the world, right? Because I think a lot of readers who are familiar with issues in cosmology and philosophy will be familiar with this aspect of quantum theory. Mm. And so they'll say, oh, yes, this is a good example of the kind of thing where we know something radically contrary to common sense must be true, but we don't know which of those radically contrary things is in fact the case.
And there are other ideas, too, that we have yet to be able to prove because we can't design an experiment. For instance, string theory. There's the whole problem with dark matter, which we're assuming is this matter that's there, but we can't see it. We can't test it. We're just assuming that it's there. And that's same for dark energy. These kinds of problems that come up in cosmology and theoretical physics, are there comparable problems in philosophy that are like that, where you can state, we think this, but we have no idea of how to arrive at a conclusion?
Right. I think consciousness is a good example
God.
Of this.
And yeah.
It isn't just philosophy. It's also, of course, neuroscience and psychology and artificial intelligence. But one of my favorite examples here is the question of whether garden snails are conscious. Right? Do they have experiences? What I mean is not do they, think to themselves, I'm a conscious being, right? But do they just have experiences? Is it there's something it's like to be a garden snail?
That's right.
Or is a garden snail, just as one snail researcher put it to me, just kind of a really complex plant-like machine, right, that doesn't really have any experiences, can't really experience pain or really have, taste experiences or anything like that, right? Is it kind of like how we ordinarily think about plants and toy robots? Or is it how we think about ourselves and, say, other vertebrates as really having experiences? Which is it like? Right? And people differ in what they think intuitively or pre-theoretically about garden snails. Some seem to think it's kind of obvious that garden snails have experiences. Others think it's obvious that they don't. You can apply different types of theories of consciousness to the case. And depending on the theory, you might come up with a yes, or you might come up with a no, or you might come up with a it's complicated. But there's no, we don't have a theory independent consciousness tester.
No, we
don't. Can then like put up against the garden snail and say, oh, yep, now we know.
Well, some of the stuff about consciousness or some kind of inner intelligence in animal behavior, they're now starting to develop some tests. I was just reading this morning about people believing that chickens have a sense of self because they can recognize themselves in a mirror. This cuts to another big problem that you talk about just in the first chapters, and that's the dualism that's bothered us since almost philosophy began. And it is weird. I mean, do we have something that's separate from our body that we could call our consciousness, or is it all just materialism? Our brain is the only thing that controls our consciousness. And those problems seem almost insolvable.
Right. I mean, we haven't figured out the answer to that yet. So there's no, I'd say the majority of scientists and philosophers are not dualists. They're materialists of one sort or another. But not everyone's convinced. It's not clear what the test would be of the existence of an immaterial substance. And there are options besides dualism and materialism as conventionally conceived that have recently become popular or that were historically popular and deserve to be reinvigorated. So the question is pretty complex.
You describe it at one point in the book as a quadrilemma. There are four horns on this dilemma. Horn one is that only human beings have immortal souls or essentially what we would call an immortal soul. Horn two is everything and everybody is in. Everything has a soul, a book, a rock, a worm, a chicken. Horn three is there's a line in the sand. Now, I've interviewed a lot of animal behaviorists, and that seems to be the popular theory right now, that there's sort of a graded idea about consciousness that goes sort of down the evolutionary chart. And then maybe we don't have to draw the line in the sand, and that was horn four. These problems, like, are, again, it's like problems about string theory and dark matter, in physics. God, I mean, it seems like we don't have any way to proceed.
Right. I think what happens is you end up with people who have their favorite tests of consciousness or self-consciousness or whatever, like as you were describing the mirror self-recognition test, you know, can it recognize itself in the mirror? And then some people are like, yeah, this is a good test. But other people are like, why would this be the criterion?
Right, right. So a chicken can recognize itself in the mirror. Next.
Right, like, so what?
So what? It's right? Exactly.
And an earthworm can't. So what? Right. So, you know, why would you have that be the test? There's no test of consciousness that doesn't presuppose already from its beginning a lot of dubious commitments to one theory or another of the nature of consciousness.
At some point, it's funny, while I was reading your book, I started to wonder, is this just a way for everybody to achieve some kind of Zen state of enlightenment, where you just sort of throw up your hands going, you know, om, because you can't do anything else but that for right now. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Eric Switzgeibel, and he's a professor of philosophy and frustration at the University of California, Riverside. And we're talking about his amazing new book. You have to read it. The Weirdness of the World. There's a problem you'd start dealing with early on in the book. And that's, you postulate that the United States as an entity could be conscious.
Right.
Yeah, go on. State that. I read deeply the chapter.
Let me lay the argument on you, sure.
And the funny thing is, at the back of the book, there's a whole list of people who are trying to say no and why.
Yes. When I came up with this argument, I hadn't found people in the philosophical tradition who had really explicitly addressed it. So I basically emailed some of the most famous living philosophers and said, hey, you probably don't think the U.S. is conscious. Why not? And they all came back with different answers that, in my view, were inadequate.
So basically, you just started a lot of arguments.
So yeah, and they all kindly, or the ones that I selected, kindly, excuse me, kindly let me quote them in the book.
Oh yeah, it's fascinating to read. So wait a minute. So why would the United States be conscious? And some of your answers are really fascinating. We have a prejudice for single entity consciousness. We look at
right.
We don't look at things like ant colonies as having
right,
a consciousness of itself.
Right. So I think the first move here is to recognize that most people, especially most people who have kind of a scientific materialist bent and aren't say, religious dualists who think that God instills a soul, but even some of them, right? Mm-hmm. At least most people would say, look, rabbits are conscious. They have experiences. We don't know about garden snails, but yeah, doesn't it seem like rabbits have like experiences of fear and visual experiences?
Yep.
Yeah, right. And also, I think most people would think that weirdly structured alien entities that were similar to us in intelligence or behavioral sophistication would be conscious, right? So the premise of like basically every science fiction movie and book that involves some weird alien, we just assume that the alien in question has experiences and is a conscious being. It's very hard not to assume that.
Go
so
ahead.
If both of those things are true, then we can think about what sorts of weird structures an alien might have and still be a conscious being. And I think there we have to assume something like, well, there could be aliens that are spatially discontinuous, that break into parts. And I talked the reader through some thought experiments about that, like alien squids that can detach their arms but are still cognitively integrated. Certainly they would still be conscious.
Well, and there's some evidence for our squids. They're and they're the most intelligent invertebrate, that their brains, their thoughts, and they are intelligent, is distributed weirdly throughout their body and their tentacles.
Yeah, so, well, it's not an accident that I chose squid.
I knew that. And then you also talked about Antarian ant heads.
Ant heads, right. So that's kind of a step further along this path from squids, right? So if you allow that there could be entities that are spatially discontinuous, that are conscious, right, maybe these could be group entities of insects. So I kind of warm the reader up into this idea by imagining this mammoth-like entity that behaves just like a human, basically,
mm-hmm.
right? But inside, it's not a brain, but instead a million squirming insects.
Right.
But somehow the interactions among all these insects give rise to this sophisticated behavior. Surely we think this thing is conscious, that, well, at least that would be the intuitive idea, that this thing would be conscious. But its consciousness is instantiated by a bunch of insects interacting rather than by a bunch of neurons interacting. I mean, what's the big difference? Right? There's going to be information transfer. There's going to be biological function, all that good stuff that mainstream scientific theorists of consciousness think is important could happen through the exchange of information among insects. So there's no reason, I think, once you get your mind into the kinds of alternative biologies they might see in other types of structures, to think that consciousness has to occur only among kind of discrete, solid,
that's right,
physically continuous entities. It could be information transfer across space that gives rise to human-like consciousness.
Just to interject something I just read yesterday in the European Journal of Science called Nature, comb jellies, which are kind of stenophore, they just witness that when one of them gets injured, it'll actually unite with another one and become one organism.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that. That's very cool.
So that sort of runs it backwards. You had two discrete organisms that are now one.
Right. I think our sense of consciousness and our sense of what an organism is so biased toward, it's highly biased toward vertebrate biology, right? And once you start looking at invertebrates, things get very different and weird. And, you know, well, invertebrates are organisms just like us and potentially could be just as sophisticated as us. All right, so let me make the final two moves in the U.S. consciousness argument. I think we'll go a little faster.
Sure.
Right, so once you're open-minded about spatially distributed entities being conscious, then you apply the rabbit and you think, well, even rabbit-like intelligent spatially distributed entities would be conscious, right? The equivalent of rabbits among spatially distributed groups. And then the final move is the United States is kind of like a rabbit intelligence here on Earth that's spatially distributed. It doesn't do things like look in the mirror and say, hey, I'm the United States, but neither do rabbits, right? It protects the boundaries of its body,
mm-hmm.
like rabbits do. It takes in information from its environment and reacts appropriately, like rabbits do. It consumes nutrients.
Mm-hmm.
It even makes statements, which rabbits don't do. It knows some things about itself, like it knows who's standing for election as president,
right.
That sort of thing.
That's right.
All these kinds of things that scientifically oriented theorists of consciousness think are characteristic of conscious entities, the things that make brains special, right? The fact that it underwrites sophisticated responsiveness to its environment, the fact that there's massive information exchange within it, all those things the United States also has. So here's the challenge, right? If you're a materialist about consciousness or you're a scientifically oriented theorist of consciousness, what is it the United States is lacking?
I know.
It's not clear what it is. I haven't seen
it's almost
answer.
As if
I said, I emailed people and said, what's missing? And they came up with different, I think, unsatisfactory answers.
Did they know there were unsatisfactory answers?
Well, you know, I doubt I convinced them.
This sounds like, is there going to be like a panel discussion at some point where all of you are going to be on a stage together yelling at each other?
That would be awesome.
Wouldn't it? I think it would be excellent.
Two of my respondents have since died, but.
Oh, that's even better. So, again, these are just, and it ends up being these are problems that you can't really solve. This just makes me want to go to the mountaintop and sit in a lotus position and erase this from my mind.
Right. I want to say two things about this, right? One is you could just say, well, look, it's intuitively obvious. It's absurd to think the United States is conscious.
Yeah, but that's not a good argument.
And right. The point is that's not a good argument. That's not what the world is like. As, for example, quantum mechanics tells us, the world does not necessarily fit very well with our pre-theoretic common sense assumptions. So we shouldn't just say, oh, I know it's absurd because it doesn't fit with common sense. Reaction two to this kind of like meditating on the mountain thing. I like that reaction. I think that part of what philosophy should do, I think philosophy at its most exciting, is philosophy that instead of telling you, here is the right answer, you were confused or didn't ignorant about something before, you didn't know which answer was right among several alternatives, I'll tell you, here's the right one. I call that the philosophy of closing. The philosophy of opening says, hey, here's something that you assumed. Here's a possibility you didn't think about. Maybe this possibility is true. You better open your mind to it. And that kind of philosophical progress, that philosophical mind opening, then makes the world epistemically wider for you. Things come into your mind. Possibilities arise to you that you hadn't even been on your map before.
That's right.
Or you'd assumed had to be false. And now for you, they're live. And I think that kind of uncertainty and the wonder that it produces and the sense that the world is full of weird possibilities is actually a wonderful state for philosophy to produce in us.
And that's your statement at the end, too, which I really appreciate, is that explore, and this is a quote, exploring the biggest philosophical questions, especially when we can't know the answer, ranks among the most intrinsically valuable human activities. And it's an interesting idea to think about, that it's almost like exercising your mind, your consciousness, to take on a different point of view and consider it, because that stuff does filter down into your everyday life. that idea.
I think it does.
I think it really does.
It's hard to be as dogmatically rigid about things in ordinary life. You've done some mind-blowing philosophy.
or you've read quantum theory.
If you read quantum
theory, it's the same way. It's like, you know, it's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle on up. I mean, it's like, there's another list in the beginning of the book is, why is metaphysics always bizarre? And one, this is my favorite, without some bizarreness, metaphysics won't sell. And that's what this book is. This is a book. This is one big advertisement for people to take a philosophy course.
I hope so. I try to write the book so that readers who don't have much philosophy can follow most of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I also had a second aim, and I'm glad that you did, right? I also had a second aim of writing something that was itself rigorous and deep enough to be an advance that also professional philosophers would benefit from, so that it's not just a distillation for a popular audience of stuff that philosophers already know, but in fact an original contribution of research philosophy alongside being something accessible for the most part to people who aren't philosophers. That's kind of like, for me, that's the ideal aim.
And it's illustrated.
I was so happy.
Agreed
to that. Yeah.
We're out of time. Obviously we could talk about this book for years and it still wouldn't be over. You're listening to my guest tonight, Eric Schwitzgebel. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of California, Riverside. And we're talking about his new book. It's wild. The Weirdness of the World. Eric, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.